This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sarah Chase woke to the sound of artillery a few weeks ago at her home in Afghanistan's Kandahar province. The Afghan army was firing on the Taliban, who were approaching. We invited Chase to talk with us about how the Taliban are using both persuasion and terror to expand their power in Afghanistan. As you may remember, Chase spent several years as an NPR reporter. In fact, she reported on the American bombing of Afghanistan and the fall of the Taliban in 2001. She decided to stay in Afghanistan and help rebuild the country. First, she worked on a project with the mission of building democracy by rebuilding villages. Now she runs a cooperative she founded in Kandahar that manufactures soap and skincare products and exports them to the U.S. and Canada. It's a project designed to help create alternatives to the poppy economy. Her article about that project is in the December issue of The Atlantic. Chase is also the author of the memoir, The Punishment of Virtue, Inside Afghanistan After the Taliban, which recently came out in paperback. This month, she's in Paris, and that's where she joins us from. Sarah Chase, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
Last month, you awoke to the sound of artillery. Would you describe that night or that morning?
You know, it was such an incredibly tense period. For basically 2 weeks, we were all on edge because a very senior and sort of historic tribal elder had died, fortunately, of a heart attack in mid-October. And we knew that this was a person who was very loyal to President Karzai and whose tribe is an important tribe in the region. And we knew that his district was going to come under attack. So already I would say that I hadn't been sleeping. You know, you just, your ears were cocked all night long to hear what was happening. One night there would be helicopter traffic, you know, just for a couple of hours there would be helicopters circling and circling. And that morning I heard heavy guns, and it's really the first time I've ever, in 6 years in southern Afghanistan, heard heavy artillery in action. And, you know, by then we knew what was going on. This district had come under attack, so it wasn't a surprise, but it was sort of like a punctuation mark at the end of a very difficult month.
Why were you expecting a Taliban attack?
This district is a very sort of symbolic place. It's just to the north of Kandahar City. It's absolutely beautiful. It has a river, this sort of meandering river studded with stones, the riverbed. And so it's where most of the fruit that's cultivated in southern Afghanistan comes from. And so the landscape around is this kind of arid moonscape. And you cross a ridge of hills and then suddenly it's this jungle of pomegranate trees, you know. And it's the place that Kandahar goes to on Fridays for picnics, and there are apricots and there are figs, and there it's like the artery of the province in a way. And significantly also, it was the place where the anti-Soviet resistance was based in the 1980s. And this was the place from which they drove the Soviets out of southern Afghanistan. And so it is thought of as a place that once an insurgency gets in there, you can't really drive them out. And it was the sort of fiefdom of this tribal elder who was very widely respected, had been the person who drove the Soviets out of southern Afghanistan in the 80s, and who was personally very loyal to President Karzai and had continuously sort of exhorted his tribesmen to stay loyal to the government in spite of their disaffection with it. And so once he died, I mean, it was just clear that the Taliban were going to take advantage of that and try to make some kind of move on his district.
So how far did they get?
Really far. You know, I mean, there was about a week or 10 days during which various friends of this elder had sort of sat around and thought about where should there be a forward operating base to prevent this from happening, and how many NATO soldiers would have to be in it, and how many Afghan army, you know, troops would have to be in them to prevent this sort of incursion. And then what was also interesting is word kind of leaked out just a few days before the incursion to the effect that, well, actually, they weren't coming after all and they were going to, you know, wait it out and maybe try next spring. And I found that really interesting after the fact because, you know, for something that's supposed to be a hodgepodge little insurgency, you know, full of rogue elements and things like that, to have deliberately disseminated false information and managed to keep the truth quiet was quite an indication of organization. And, you know, they came into the district on a Monday morning, immediately established themselves in the house of this tribal elder, which was, again, an incredibly symbolic thing to say. Like, you know, within 2 weeks of his death, we're inside his house, and you can't stop us. And then there was a big council of war on the NATO base that evening. So they basically were left in possession of a large part of the district for the day. And then there was a kind of NATO and Afghan counterattack, which lasted 2 or 3 days and eventually drove the Taliban back. Now, that left people at the international military base feeling quite happy and proud of themselves.
But you think this is still a victory of sorts for the Taliban?
I do. I actually don't really think that they were setting out to occupy and own that district right then and there. I think they were, it was a kind of psychological operations, you know? They were trying to demonstrate that they were there, that they could do what they wanted to do, and execute a fighting withdrawal, which is a relatively difficult thing to do, and let that sort of psychological impact have its effect over the coming weeks and months. And I suspect they'll be back in the spring. And I think that they really succeeded. They lost a lot of people. They lost something like 50 people. But sometimes a battle can actually be a psychological operations move. In other words, psychological operations are usually thought of as, you know, radio messages and leaflets and things like that. But sometimes you can even be willing to lose people in order to have a certain psychological impact. And I actually think they were quite successful.
So if you think the Taliban had a psychological impact in your area of Afghanistan, how do you think they're now going to capitalize on that?
They've already started. For example, one of my cooperative members is from this district of Arghandab, and a bomb was placed right on the little dirt road right near his village, outside his village. I think it was about 2 or 3 weeks ago after this operation. In other words, I think what you're going to see is a combination of quiet persuasion, where you'll have Taliban coming to mosques on Fridays and sitting around with people after dinner, you know, when people like to sit and drink tea and discuss and things like that. And they'll try to persuade the people of Arghandab that, well, you know, this government hasn't really done anything for you anyway. And we don't have anything against you. We're not going to take any revenge on you for having sided with the government. All we want is, you know, to fight against the government and against the foreigners. So just let us set up shop here. That's going to be one side. And then the other side is going to be a kind of negative persuasion through terror operations like this bomb that was placed outside my cooperative member's village and occasional assassinations of people who are close to the government or the foreigners who are present in Afghanistan. And it's really devastating for ordinary Afghans. They've been through 30 years of combat and they're traumatized. And so it doesn't take a lot to actually cause them to change their behavior out of intimidation. So that my cooperative member, for example, is for the first time in his life thinking of actually leaving Arghandab and moving his family into town because it's becoming too dangerous for him.
When the Taliban say, this government, the Karzai government, hasn't done anything for you, are they right? Is there an element of truth in that?
There really is. And it's not just a question of material benefits like, you know, have roads been built or have schools been built or has wheat been distributed or something like that. It is the rampant corruption of this government. It is so painful to watch, quite frankly. You can't have an interaction with a government official without having to pay a bribe. And it means, I mean, for example, to pay your electricity bill, if you have electricity, you have to actually go to seven different desks in two different buildings, and you have to pay bribes at most of those desks in order to pay your bill, you know? And whatever it is, if it's being shaken down by police, a police checkpost on a street corner, if it's depositing money in the National Bank, if it's getting, you know, an official document like a license or something like that, you always have to, and you're badly treated. You're treated like some lower form of life. And money is extracted from you. And it's so bad that people basically feel like the Taliban and the government are two factions fighting over whatever, you know, material benefits there may be in Afghanistan, like humanitarian assistance and customs and, you know, sources of money like that, not to mention drug money. So these two factions are fighting, and both factions are preying upon the ordinary civilians. I had somebody tell me it's like if you tried to balance on two watermelons, you know, one foot on one watermelon and the other foot on the other watermelon. We don't know which way to jump. The Taliban, you know, prey on us at night, and the government preys on us in the daytime.
Sarah, earlier in your life in Afghanistan, you worked on a project, a development project with one of Hamid Karzai's brothers. And I'm wondering if you used to have faith in Hamid Karzai and his government, and if you subsequently lost it.
I did. I had tremendous faith. You know, I was reporting for NPR during the U.S.-led bombing campaign and during and right after the fall of the Taliban. And I remember Hamid Karzai was inside Afghanistan for part of that period and was giving radio interviews and really inspiring his countrymen. And so my faith in them, I didn't know them prior to doing this reporting, but my faith in them, I got through the feelings of ordinary Afghans. In other words, the kind of electrification of hope and of inspiration that he was able to transmit to people, I thought, wow, you know, if this isn't Nelson Mandela, it's at least, you know, our decade's version of a real statesman. And I was really inspired by the possibilities that were opening up for Afghanistan after the fall of the Taliban. And I have become disillusioned because I really feel as though President Karzai was brought to power on an just resounding mandate to clean up the government, to provide respectful, responsive, and accountable government to his people, and in particular to get notorious warlords out of town that everybody knew. I mean, these were people who were entirely repudiated by the Afghan population and came back into Afghanistan more or less on the American coattails. I mean, these were people who had been sort of put together as a posse by American officials to help chase al-Qaeda, but who were in no way up to the job of running Afghanistan after the Taliban were fully out. And so, you know, when I would interview people, I would ask them, how do you feel about the coming fall of the Taliban? And they would say, we're delighted, we're overjoyed. The only thing we're worried about is that the warlords will come back and take power again. And that's exactly what happened. And President Karzai had a real mandate to clear them out of government. And instead, he really, each stage has been a process of legitimization of these individuals that the Afghan population did not want to be governed by. And so I'm very disappointed. It's almost as though he's presiding over a kind of free-for-all, a kind of gang rape of his country. And at some point, that becomes his responsibility.
Sarah, you know, we were talking about the Taliban attack last month in the part of Kandahar where you've been living, and how you think that although they lost the particular battle, they won in terms of it being a psychological operation, and now people in that area are really afraid. You also say in the recent op-ed piece that you wrote in the Washington Post that there's been these kind of drums beating for including the Taliban in a power-sharing arrangement. Where are you hearing those drums coming from?
President Karzai was one of the first ones recently to bring it to the fore when he, in a sort of rhetorical way, said, you know, if I could just have Mullah Muhammad Omar's telephone number, I'd call him up and you know, we would offer a deputy ministership or something like that to the Taliban if they would just stop fighting, which I found to be a pretty extraordinary statement for him to make publicly. You're hearing it in London. President Karzai was recently in London and at a press conference after meetings that he had with Gordon Brown. Both men, you know, made allusions to bringing all parties to the table and political activity that has to happen alongside the military activity. On the ground in Afghanistan, there are a lot of sort of rumors about secret and very high-level talks going on between envoys of President Karzai and members of the Taliban. So it's clear that this is in the air.
What are your concerns about this? I mean, a power-sharing agreement might stop the fighting in Afghanistan.
See, I don't actually believe that the Taliban are a homegrown insurgency, ideologically based insurgency. I actually think that particularly what we've seen active in southern Afghanistan has been pretty much ginned up by the Pakistani Military Intelligence Agency, which is what created the Taliban in the first place in 1994. The Taliban happened, kind of emerged as a movement, not in Afghanistan, but in Pakistan. And it was always a kind of proxy through which the Pakistani military hoped to control Afghanistan to the degree that it could. And I really don't think that that policy has changed much. And I have a lot of specific evidence, including, you know, Pakistani army officers teaching in these training camps, including high-level Taliban driving around Quetta, Pakistan in cars with license plates that are military license plates. I mean, it's been really, really clear. And so if you bring this group to the negotiating table, in a way what you're doing is saying, well, then we will cede in one way or another control or partial control over part of Afghanistan to Pakistan. And I really don't think that's an appropriate thing to do.
If you see the Taliban as the proxy of Pakistan, what do you see Pakistan's ambition as being in Afghanistan?
It's been really clear for more than 30 years now, they've really been looking to exercise a kind of proxy control over Afghanistan. And it was clear throughout the 1980s when it was through Pakistan that all the international funding for the anti-Soviet resistance factions was funneled. And the Pakistani government, in particular military, carefully sent the bulk of this money to one faction, which was a kind of extremist faction, which Pakistan hoped would then take over Afghanistan once the Soviets withdrew. Interestingly, Afghanistan had absolutely no intention of being governed by an extremist Islamist leadership. And so what you got was a civil war where all the other groups were not interested in this extremist leader taking control over the country. And so there was this very difficult to live with chaos. And I mean, parts of Kabul were leveled, and in Kandahar in the south, I mean, people could hardly cross town without being shaken down by the gunmen of different groups and things like that. And so at the end of that, by 1994, Afghanistan was so exhausted that almost anything looked better than this chaos that had been perpetrated on them. And the Pakistani government realized that the guy that it was hoping to install in power in Afghanistan was not going to win. It was not going to work. And so that's when you saw the Taliban as created as a kind of alternative. So I really think that the Pakistani government has quite consistently tried to exercise control by proxy over Afghanistan.
But here's what doesn't make sense to me. The Taliban don't seem to like Pakistan's President Musharraf. My impression is they want him out of power. So I don't understand why he would want to use them as his proxy in Afghanistan.
It's a case of the sorcerer's apprentice. You know, this is a proxy that has been instrumentalized for a long time by the Pakistani government, and now it is escaping control to some extent.
So you're saying it's not Musharraf who initiated it?
No. I mean, it was, as I say, all through the 1980s.
Right.
Extremists have been instrumentalized by the Pakistani government, both in Kashmir and in Afghanistan. And I think what's happened is that in certain places, they're starting to take on a life of their own.
Now, how has daily life changed in the part of Kandahar where you live since the Taliban attack?
It's just gotten more and more constrained. Basically, everybody I know is absolutely terrified. I just lost one of the women in my cooperative who decided not to continue working with us because women in her neighborhood had been intimidated, and so she's afraid to work for us. And so everyone, what you feel is that people are reducing their movements. They don't move around as much. And pretty much everyone calculates that either themselves or a member of their immediate family will die in the next 3 days.
You've mentioned a couple of people who have been threatened in your soap cooperative. Is there something that's considered subversive about the cooperative?
Not specifically, but because I am a foreigner, I'm seen as being part of this whole post-Taliban construct, you know. And that's where it's quite interesting because many humanitarians try to draw these great distinctions between them and the international military forces and the Afghan government. But from the perspective of ordinary Afghans, as well as from the perspective of these armed opponents, it's all part and parcel of the same thing. So there's really not a lot of difference between me and, let's say, a Canadian soldier.
Well, in that case, you must be under quite a threat yourself if you're seen as one of the infidels.
It's the first time that I'm actually really starting to feel a bit nervous, I have to say. It's the first time in 6 years that I feel like the situation has gotten enough out of control and that the threat has diversified enough that I really have to be more careful than I have been in the past. And so I myself reduced my movements a lot. For the first time, I normally drive around town alone, and my cooperative members wouldn't let me anymore. They said, you will not leave here without somebody else in the car with you. And so I am taking more precautions than I have in the past.
It seems to me you must really stand out there. And you know, because how many foreigners are in the part of Kandahar where you work, and how many women foreigners are there heading up a project and being as, you know, assertive and out there as you are? Doesn't your visibility really make you a target?
You know, in the past, I think my visibility actually protected me to some degree because, again, if you go back to the notion that this up until, let's say, a year ago, was primarily orchestrated and run by the Pakistani government. Washington provides Pakistan with $1 billion a year, you know, in military and other funding. And so my hypothesis was that while the Pakistani military was doing what it could to keep the water very warm in southern Afghanistan, it didn't really want the water to boil over. And it didn't, you know, really want a bunch of dead American civilians to cause Washington to maybe reexamine its policy. Now things are getting a little bit more complicated because, as you pointed out, there is a kind of radicalization of certain groups of the Taliban who may not be in control of the ISI anymore. There are a lot of people who have suffered casualties, whose family members have been killed by, you know, NATO actions and who have a kind of blood feud against internationals because of that. In other words, you know, your brother gets killed and you kind of have to extract revenge. And this American lady running around is just as good, you know, a target of revenge as anybody else. And I've also irritated a number of Afghan government officials. And the more chaotic the environment becomes, the easier it is for, let's say, non-Taliban actions to be dressed up as Taliban actions. So you're right. You're absolutely right. And that's why I kind of feel like I have to dodge a little bit more than I have in the past.
You know, you've said that you're worried not just about threats or attacks by the Taliban, but it's possible for the government or for agents of the government to attack people and make it look like it's really the Taliban. How worried are you about that? Have you seen that happen?
Yeah. And in fact, I've received 2 death threats and a IED, these acronyms that we've all gotten used to, an improvised bomb placed outside my house. And that all of those things were from agents of the government. They weren't the Taliban, but they were dressed up to look like the Taliban. So that in one case, the threat was transmitted to me via the CIA, who had heard that, you know, there's an extremist operational cell that's targeting the CIA agent who's dressed up to look like a journalist named Sarah, who drives thus and such a car around town. It was really crazy. And it just didn't smell right to me. And I suggested to them, you don't think this might be the governor? And they dismissed that. But when I got the second one some months later that was very much echoed the first in terminology, I sent some officials, both international and Afghan, to the governor to basically tell him that if anything happened to me, he would be held responsible. And I never heard another word. It was clear to me that that was coming from the governor. And it was quite clear to me that at least the CIA at that time was totally taken in by the description of the threat as a terrorist-type threat.
What does the governor have against you?
Well, I was trying to get him removed. He was one of these warlords. He has since been sent to another province, but I was very vocal about – I didn't have anything against him personally, but he very much represented the sort of warlord governance that Afghans were just desperate about. And so I was quite vocal, both in public and in, you know, interactions with President Karzai, for example, saying, you know, this is the kind of guy you got to get rid of. And so the governor got very upset and told President Karzai that so long as, you know, this Sarah was in his province, he couldn't govern and get rid of her and all of this kind of thing.
Oh, sounds scary.
It wasn't, because I was pretty sure that he wasn't going to follow up on it. He was trying to intimidate me, and I could kind of read it in that context. And so, as I say, when the second one came, I felt I again wasn't scared, but I felt like, okay, in local power politics, what I have to do is show him that I'm not intimidated. And the way I did that was to ask, the interior minister said something, the U.S. embassy said something, and some of the military folks at the base out in Kandahar said something to the governor, and he got scared. It was really interesting. Now I'm much more scared. Because now I don't feel as though the threats are as clearly perceptible as they were then.
And now you think threats really would be coming from the Taliban?
Yes, I do think the threat could come from Taliban. But I also think that the situation is chaotic enough that it might be possible for officials with a grievance to do something without it really clearly appearing that it was them.
My guest is Sarah Chase. She's a former NPR reporter who covered the fall of the Taliban in 2001. When her assignment ended in Afghanistan in 2002, she stayed in the country to help rebuild it. Her memoir, The Punishment of Virtue, was recently published in paperback. Sarah, one of the first projects that you worked on was a project to build democracy by helping to physically rebuild villages.
Yeah.
And now you're heading a cooperative that manufactures soap and other skincare products and exports them to the United States and Canada. Now, the idea behind that project, you know, soap isn't the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is self-sufficiency and jobs. But, you know, when I think of the scope of rebuilding villages and homes to rebuild democracy versus making soap and exporting it, the scope of the ideal there seems to be having gotten a lot more smaller and localized and, you know, kind of scaled down. Can you talk about that different change in scope of the projects and what's behind that?
Yeah, you're really onto something with that. And it's not just that houses are bigger than bars of soap, but it's that, you know, when I first went in, I wanted to be part of a process of rebuilding institutions and a whole a kind of governance that would be responsive to the needs of Afghans, of the ordinary Afghan population, where they felt that they had input into their collective destiny. And unfortunately, this to me has been the real failure of the international presence in Afghanistan. Because, you know, often I'm asked, for example, are we right to impose democracy on people who just, you know, don't want it or aren't ready for it or this or that? And when you think about it, let's see, what have we imposed? Well, we brought in really hardened criminals and put them in positions of political power. We presided over at least parliamentary elections that were really, really deeply corrupt. There have been black sites, places where torture has been undertaken at the behest of U.S. officials. I don't really think that's American democracy as I understand it. And so, in fact, rather than bringing democracy to Afghanistan, what I experience that we've done is actually to obstruct it. And I think the only answer to the deterioration of the situation is to radically change course in that regard. We have got to start holding to account the government officials that we help bring to power. And so while I make soap, I also agitate for that to happen. I don't sort of only make soap. But what's fascinating about making soap is that it brings you into contact with a lot of the issues that are encountered by ordinary Afghans. And so I've got concrete examples that, you know, I can bring to NATO and U.S. officials when I make my plea. But it's certainly true that in the current kind of dire situation I have, you know, I after this attack on Arghandab district, I was thinking, okay, well, what, you know, let's say there is negotiation with the Taliban and some kind of rebranded Taliban gets its hands on, you know, five southern governorships. Well, then what do I do? Let's see, you know. And my feeling is that I can't condone that kind of an Afghanistan by my deep involvement. On the other hand, I've got 12 families that are surviving based on this cooperative that I founded. And there are all sorts of production, you know, processes that we've developed and whole products that we've developed. And so I started getting really adaptable and thinking, let's see, well, how could I continue to run this at a distance if need be? Would we have to separate the working space of women and men? I mean, literally, I started thinking in those directions. And so it is interesting how you become adaptable just like Afghans.
You become adaptable for survival. You want those families to survive. You want your work to survive.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, do you want to make the kind of compromises where your freedom as a woman would be close to non-existent?
Not myself, no. For example, one of my cooperative members said, you know, you can't go out anymore except in a burqa. I said, no way. You know, I refuse to accept that kind of Afghanistan. And that's why I've had to adapt to some extent, you know, the amount of time that I'm planning to spend on the ground and things like that. And it's a pretty heavy psychological transition, I have to say.
Sarah, the last time we spoke, and this was in 2003, you said that you dressed basically like an Afghan man when you were in Afghanistan because you were more comfortable in a male's clothes, you know, pants and a loose-fitting top, than you would have been in a woman's clothes in Afghanistan, and you certainly weren't going to, you know, veil yourself. What are you wearing now, nowadays?
Same thing. And I actually stopped for a while. For a while, I was wearing loose-fitting Western clothes. And now, because of the security situation, I've gone back to, you know, turban and the whole thing, because the idea is to create an optical illusion, you know, so that I look like the man that people expect me to be. And really, it's like not being a target of opportunity. Let's say there's a guy who's wired up, you know, and he's been waiting for a military convoy to drive past, and it's not showing up. And so he decides to choose a target of opportunity. If I'm an obvious foreigner who happens past him at that time, it can be fatal.
What are some of the places you've been to in Afghanistan where you're the only woman, and it's very unusual or perhaps impossible for an Afghan woman to be present at that situation?
Partly meetings with Afghan officials, you know, going to see the governor. The governor will have a kind of, it's almost like office hours, but it's a sort of, it's called a majlis, and it's when he hears people's grievances and things like that, but in a public setting. And so other people are listening in and will chime in and things like that. And it's inconceivable that an Afghan woman would be part of that majlis. And more movingly, funerals. I've been to the funerals of two dear friends, one of whom was assassinated, and then this tribal elder that we mentioned earlier who died in the middle of October. And, I mean, somebody actually asked an Afghan when he heard about this as to, you know, does this ever happen? And the Afghan said, not only is this rare, it's unheard of. And I think part of the reason is that the person you really want to be in Afghanistan is a foreign female, because as a female, you can interact with women. But as a foreigner, you kind of, it's like the third sex. You're allowed to interact with men in ways that Afghan women never, never could. And in this particular case, these were friends of mine. And I was very moved that their families and their, you know, close friends saw me as that and accepted me in these assemblies.
Do you think in any way your presence in these kinds of situations as a woman, albeit as a foreign woman, makes people maybe question their feelings about women, you know, that women are incapable of doing certain things and don't belong in many places?
I doubt it, because what they can say is, well, she's a Westerner and they're different, you know, as though there's something different in the water, you know, on the other side of the world. And I often tell people there is no difference, you know, between me and an Afghan woman. It's just the context that I grew up in and that my society offered me certain advantages and opportunities and challenges that you refuse to offer your women. But it has a big impact on women. And sometimes I think the impact may be very invisible, and it may be things like that, like when I go to a girls' school and get out of my truck that I just drove into the courtyard, and all the girls come running and they say, oh my goodness, there's a woman driving a truck. Women don't drive in Kandahar. And so I'm hoping that just my presence may have some sort of ripple effect that I can't discern, and that's different from whatever the direct impact of what I'm doing with my cooperative or with my arguments with Afghan and international officials.
Do you have any Western friends in Afghanistan who you can talk to who really understand your frame of reference?
That's a really good question, and the answer is not really. And I think that that's one of the most difficult things about living there is the kind of intellectual and psychological isolation, because I'm very close with my cooperative members, and we talk, you know, a lot, and the guys take turns spending the night, so we always have dinner and a kind of really – and in some ways, I'm a friend to them in ways that they couldn't have even among their male friends, because, again, they can talk to me about their intimate lives in ways that they can't with their male friends. But I don't really have anyone that I can share my approach to the country, because it's a bit different from the typical approach of humanitarian workers.
My guest is Sarah Chase. In 2001, she covered the fall of the Taliban for NPR. She stayed on in Afghanistan to help rebuild the country and now runs a cooperative in Kandahar. The soap cooperative that you founded and run, which provides income for 12 families now in Afghanistan, you created through private foundations, you know, charities, I think like grants, individual donors, things like that. You initially tried to go through the official aid channels, the groups that give money as contractors through the U.S., USAID, the United States Agency for International Development. You gave up on those channels because of the bureaucracy.
Yeah.
Give us a sense of what you were expected to do and why you gave up even trying.
Well, you know, what we're doing, it's not just that we provide a livelihood for 12 families and more because we buy our raw materials from local farmers. But in fact, what it is an anti-opium project. In other words, our notion is that the best way to beat opium is compete with it. And so if you can expand the market for licit local agriculture, then you're going to make headway against opium. And there's a USAID-funded project, $119 million over 5 years, designed supposedly to support precisely this, alternative livelihoods. And it was just insane. I mean, I spent a year trying to climb through their hoops before being turned down. We did then get a grant from them the second year, and it was supposed to be a shoo-in to get a follow-on grant after that. And we're really the only project in southern Afghanistan that is successfully pulling this off because, as you mentioned, we export our soap and body oils to the U.S. and Canada. We are swamped in demand. We literally cannot keep up with demand. You know, so there's plenty of room for expansion of us, for expansion of the model and things like that. And I just found that it was almost as though they were putting you through hoops for the fun of putting you through hoops. And I also think that there is a tendency on the part of USAID to want to fund gargantuan projects. You know, so they spent a couple of $100,000 doing a feasibility study for a several million-dollar dairy in the next province over from us. And I had actually done dairy for a while in Kandahar, and I could have told them for free why their idea was unfeasible and what kind of an idea would have been feasible. And, you know, so the first time we got turned down, we were turned down in part because, you know, we weren't big enough. And I was trying to tell them, look, this is a brand new product in a saturated market, and I'm operating in an active theater of war. I cannot promise you now that I am going to have a factory with 100 people in it. You know, let me build this up step by step, organically, according to, you know, how well the product is doing, how our working environment functions, and things like that. And then we'll see where we get. And they just weren't interested.
Would it be going too far to say that, in your opinion, a lot of the aid money going into Afghanistan benefits the contractors more than the people it's intended to benefit?
That is absolutely clear. I mean, the people who were the, let's say, program officers when we did get our USAID-funded contract, they were making between $100,000 and $200,000 a year base pay, plus 35% for hazard pay, 35% because they don't live at home, and 10% more because they had to work on Saturdays. So they were making, let's say, $200,000 to $300,000 a year, and USAID was paying the contracting company $500,000 to $600,000 per person. And, you know, I mean, that eats through aid dollars really, really fast, plus tens of thousands of dollars in rental for their facilities. They all drive around in brand new, often armored, vehicles. They've got heavy security details. It costs a fortune. And Afghans see it, and they're a little bit upset about it because they understand that that was money that was earmarked for Afghanistan, and they see it going back into the pockets of the contractors.
You know, I recently had on the show somebody named Joel Havenstein, who his memoir Opium Season is about working for a contractor in Afghanistan whose job was to create jobs for people in Afghanistan that would be an alternative to the poppy economy. And he kind of gave up on that project when security just got so bad and, you know, several of his men were killed. And he thought, like, you just really can't move forward with these kinds of development projects until you have sufficient security. And that security just didn't exist. That's basically what his book is about. So I'm wondering, from your point of view now, how much security is an issue in going forward with everything that you think Afghanistan needs to do on the large and small level to move forward?
It's a huge issue. I mean, that's the same contractor that I interacted with, and I'm dying to read that book, which I haven't gotten my hands on yet. But he's talking about an event that happened in 2005. And quite frankly, the security situation wasn't so bad that you couldn't operate between 2005 and now. But it's definitely an issue. We distributed solar-powered water pumps to three of our cooperative members who own land, and they've had to take the panels down because it makes them a target. So the issue isn't just security for development workers. It's worse. It's that recipients of development projects are now saying thanks but no thanks because the situation is so bad that accepting your help is going to mark me out and make me a target in the future. I still think that security would be vastly improved if there was an improvement in governance, because the other problem is that ordinary Afghan citizens are not sticking up for their government because the government isn't sticking up for them. And so they say, why should we stick our necks out for a government that is preying upon us rather than providing services and supporting us. Whereas if the Afghans felt pride in their government, you would see them start to stand up to defend it, and they themselves would clear their areas of Taliban.
Sarah, any observations or thoughts you want to leave us with?
You know, I feel as though we've been a bit pessimistic in the course of this conversation, and I think that's accurate. But I do not believe that Afghanistan is a lost cause. And I think that if we turn our backs on Afghanistan, I mean, the reason I stayed was not just because I liked the country, but because I really felt that what happens in Afghanistan is going to have a big impact on what the 21st century is going to look like and whether we're going to live in, you know, in a divided bipolar world the way we did through much of the 20th century. And I actually think that the remedies for Afghanistan are not that difficult. And it really has to, it's very practical. It's not an ideological or cultural thing. It's practical. It's about creating, you know, government systems that are responsive to the needs of the citizens. And I feel that we've really neglected our duty in that regard. And if we were to really put our efforts into that agenda, things would change rapidly for the better.
Well, I wish you well and, you know, good luck with your project. And thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Terry.
Sarah Chase is a former NPR reporter who has lived in Afghanistan since covering the fall of the Taliban. Her memoir is called The Punishment of Virtue. Her article about her soap cooperative is in the December edition of The Atlantic. You can find a link to the article and a link to her slideshow of pictures from Afghanistan on our website, freshair.npr.org. And here's one more thing you can do on our website. You can download podcasts of our show.